Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Clary, Executive Director here at PERS. You'll notice when you came in, we had comment cards that we were asking people to fill out if they wanted to comment on any of the particular agenda items today. And we received a number of them up here, and that'll allow the chair both to call people by name as well as see what kind of time allocation he needs to make. And also, we wanted to make sure that people, if they had comments that they didn't necessarily want to make orally, or they had questions that they want us to address in our further planning, our frequently asked questions, our open houses and presentations, feel free to use the back of those cards to write that down and just leave them in your chair or leave them with a staff member at the end of the session today. We have, of course, received well over 200, perhaps now up to around 300 comment letters and emails, and we've provided everything that we had to date to the board, provided copies of those. Here's a set of them, and we've received some more today that we provided. And we also use those comments and questions to kind of inform our analysis and our recommendations here today. So it's important for us to continue that process. And I can tell you that, you know, the comments asked us to address what was legally permissible, what was fiscally sound, and what was consistent with the board's fiduciary obligations. And indeed, those comments helped us develop the three criteria that we use to try to evaluate options. And the comments also said that if you must reduce existing benefit payments, do it in a manner that minimizes impact on current benefit levels and spread repayment out over the longest time possible. That helped inform our recommended method. And then finally, one that I, as the administrator of this agency, particularly appreciated was a comment that said, if you're going to do something, keep it as simple as possible. Because if it's simple for you to do, it's simple for you to explain, and it's simple for us to understand, and this is something where everybody needs to understand. And so, again, I appreciate all the comments that have been provided to date, and I wanted to assure the crowd and others that they helped us in the evaluation, and we'll look forward to additional comments as we develop frequently asked questions, open house presentations, and so forth in this continuing process. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let me just say that I want to acknowledge all the emails and letters that we've received, and as board members, we have taken the time to read them all, and that this is not an easy topic for anybody, and we also have other lives and other jobs as well. But I want to assure people that we have taken the time to try to understand this issue that's impacting people's lives, and I realize that people that are retired that find themselves in this situation are not responsible for the issues that are before them, but neither is this board the one that created the problem that we're having to deal with today, and I hope there'd be some recognition of that as well. Recognizing that we've got limited time to get through everything today, we thought about what's the best way in terms of a process on how to proceed. What we're going to do is we're going to have Mr. Rothman of the PERS staff give a presentation about the issue and the recommendation of the staff going forward. The board will probably have some questions for Mr. Rothman. Then we're going to ask lawyers representing various constituencies to give their perspective on this. Mr. Hartman, who represents the coalition, Mr. Gary, who represents the selected employers, and Mr. Joseph Malik, who represents the board. And then we have some panels of people that have agreed to represent others in terms of their constituencies. For instance, the OEA, and also employer representatives. And after we get through that, I've got a list of people that have indicated they want to speak. Now, I have to say, my sense is that I'm probably not going to hear anything new at the end of an hour and a half to 2 hours. I will have some limit on this, and we're going to try to shoot for 2:30, we end up going a bit beyond that based on where we're at, fine, but I just kind of want to say my goal is to get everything out today. I think people will understand we won't be able to stay here and hear every single person that's expressed a desire to speak today. And I appreciate your understanding. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Rodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Steve Rodman with PERS. I'm also joined by Craig Stroud, who's the Administrator of the Benefit Payments Division. What I have for you is a presentation that summarizes the agenda item in front of you and provides some updated information as far as examples and numbers go that we've developed over the intervening week. So Mr. Stroud and I would like to go through this presentation just to kind of lead you to the point that we're at today and reflect the staff's analysis and recommendation that we come to you with. Just as an overview, we're going to start with the results of the Eugene decision and talk about how that leads us to implementation of the settlement agreement. Then, if knowing that we need to implement the settlement agreement, the next step was where do we find the funds necessary to fulfill our obligations. And the problematic portion of those funds deals with the Tier 1 member accounts. So we explore the alternatives to the funding source of Tier 1 member accounts, looked at the different suggested alternatives like administrative expenses, and led us down to the direct recovery method, which we'll go into more detail, specifically regarding what we call the actuarial reduction proposal, which is one of the methods provided in the statute for direct recovery of an overpayment, and then, of course, cover some other issues like charge-offs, waivers, et cetera. So that's a roadmap for where the presentation will take us. The Supreme Court's decision in the City of Eugene case basically was that the controversy was made moot by the 2003 PERS reform legislation and the settlement agreement that this agency entered into with the petitioning employers in that case. Currently, that settlement agreement and issues surrounding that decision are in challenge in the White case, and that's proceeding separately in Old Loma Circuit Court. The settlement agreement that it was entered into back in 2004 imposed upon this agency some specific requirements. One was that we change our variable match calculation method. That was made effective July 1, 2004. We were to reallocate 1999 employer and variable earnings. That was effective in March 2004. So these are decisions that this board has already made in implementation of that agreement. Also, the board adopted in April of 2004 a contingent order reallocating those 1999 earnings. And that reallocation was to provide 7.5% of the 1999 earnings to the contingency reserve, to fund the gain loss reserve up to its 30-month funding level, and to credit 11.33% to Tier 1 regular member accounts. That rate order was contingent on the outcome of the Strunk challenges. The Strunk case was the Oregon Supreme Court case that dealt with the challenges to the 2003 reform legislation. Because of the outcome of that case, where two provisions were found to be unconstitutional, our obligation under the settlement agreement to take these actions was triggered. I would just also note that employer rates and reserves have been adjusted accordingly for these actions, except for that contingent reallocation. So employer rates are not going to be affected by this action. The sources of funds then have to be looked at to find where the money will come from to fund the contingency and gain loss reserves up to the levels that are required by that rate order. So our staff recommendation is that we follow the earnings crediting practice of the period for the year 1999, which was equal crediting. In other words, if the Tier 1 rates are to be reduced to 11.33% under the earnings crediting policies in place at the time, employer accounts would also receive 11.33%, and the benefits in force reserve would receive 11.33%. So we would be reducing crediting to employer accounts and to the benefits in force reserve to be co-equal with the crediting that would go to Tier 1 regular accounts under the settlement agreement. So in terms of dollars, that's what this table shows you. To work across on each row, just if I might, employers would then contribute $169 million of their earnings from 1999 into the contingency reserve, a further $669 million to the gain loss reserve, So you see a total that employers would be giving up of their 1999 earnings allocation of $838 million, and that represents almost 32.5% of the funds that are necessary to credit those sources that we need to under the settlement agreement. The benefits enforced reserve, you see the numbers there as well, $221 million going to the contingency reserve, $875 to gain loss, 42.6% of the contribution to those reserves will come out of the benefits enforced reserve and go into those reserves. You see the Tier 1 numbers then as well, $128 million to contingency, $510 million to the gain loss, for a total of $638 million being recredited or reallocated out of Tier 1 accounts and into those reserves. A note, if I might, about Tier 2. The earnings crediting at the policy at the time did not deal with the contingency reserve. In other words, there was no allocation to the contingency reserve in 1999. That was one of the issues that Judge Lipscomb found to have been at fault and one of the remedies we need to execute under the settlement agreement. Normally, the earnings from a Tier 2 account would be subject to funding the contingency reserve. In other words, a contingency reserve can be funded up to 7.5% of a year's income if the income exceeds the assumed rate. And Tier 2 would usually share in that funding. Our recommendation to you is to not reallocate Tier 2 earnings for 1999. And instead, that we just have the funding to the contingency reserve come out of employers, BIF, and Tier 1. As I talked about in my memo, to add that complication into Tier 2 would dramatically expand the number of accounts and the number of transactions that we would need to go back and redo. And as you can see, their contribution would be only just over $2 million. So when you're talking about an allocation of $518 million, which that summary number there does not include the $2 million that's asterisked in the table, we would again recommend that Tier 2 not be part of that allocation. So this is where the allocation would lead to in a total, as you can see, of a reallocation of just over $2.5 billion into the contingency and gain loss reserves. Before I leave that slide, I guess I just want to reemphasize the math. And that is that we need to have that $638 million contributed from Tier 1 accounts, and that's the Tier 1 accounts in existence in 1999, in order for this table to balance, in order for the funding levels to match, in order for this agency to meet its obligation under the settlement agreement to fund the contingency and gain loss reserve up to the levels mandated. So that leads us to the next problem. If we're going to have to take $638 million out of Tier 1 accounts, the accounts that were in existence in 1999, what's the way to do that? Current Tier 1 members, there's about 100,000 of them, will receive in their next annual statement a new balance, which shows a reallocation of their account in 1999 earnings to their account down to 11.33 from 20%. So their ending balance in 99, in essence, will be reduced. They'll receive, of course, 8%, the assumed rate, earnings in 2000, 2001, and 2002, as they normally did. The Strunk decision also told us that we need to credit them with 8% in 2003. So when we send them their next annual statement, that new balance will be reflected after this reallocation. So we'll see that their account dropped from the 99 allocation, or if you track it through, you would know that the allocation dropped after that, their balance dropped after that allocation, and again went back up after the intervening credit occurred. So the point is, a Tier 1 regular member who currently has an account will, in their next annual statement, see what their new balance is after this reallocation. Then the issue comes up about accounts that have closed since the 99 earnings. These are accounts that are no longer in existence. And the categories that we've written them down into are, first, there are retired members. People that retire no longer have a regular account in their name. Their account gets transferred over to the Benefits and Force Reserve. There's roughly 32,700 of those individuals that we've identified. And note that of those, 27,000 of those people are in an overpayment situation. In other words, they've been paid more than they would have under this reallocation. There's 5,500 of those people that the agency owes money to. In other words, they're in a positive balance because of the over of the earnings allocation for 2003 or the COLA freeze or any number of factors. Those 5,500 people are actually owed money by the agency. They're not, they don't owe money to us on a net-net basis. We've got just over 6,000 withdrawals, just over 700 beneficiaries who withdrew an account after the death of a member prior to retirement. We have about 841 similar withdrawals that happened after the accounts were split from ultimate payees. And then we have a category of individuals who had a regular account to receive credit in 99 because even though they retired earlier, they took a partial lump sum option with installments, and as long as those installments were payable, their account stayed active, and so their account would have been active during that 99 period. That's about 573 people. So the board's actuary has estimated if we didn't recover the money that we are looking to recover, approximately $1.6 billion in UAL reductions will not occur. And you see the split between active Tier 1s, inactive Tier 1s, and retired members. So to not take any action to recover these funds would have this sort of impact on the unfunded actuarial liability of the system. So then we took our analysis to the point of where the source of those Tier 1 recoveries may come from. And the first place we looked was, is it possible for us to charge that off all to administrative expenses? There's a couple of tracks that will lead you to that possibility. One is a provision in House Bill 2003 from the 2003 legislation, which gave this board that one avenue, or that avenue is one of the avenues, to recover costs for incorrect benefit calculations in the City of Eugene case. That provision was reviewed by the Department of Justice and in an opinion by Hardy Myers, which was provided to Tony Corcoran's request, Senator Tony Corcoran. The DOJ raised questions about the feasibility of that option. And it is reflected in the fiscal and fiduciary analysis that we did on that, which is basically by charging that cost to administrative expenses, we shift the burden entirely to current Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, because another provision in that 2003 law also said if you charge it to administrative expenses, you can't charge it to the employers. So Tier 1 and Tier 2 current and future members would have to assume those costs in earnings that would have to be directed to these administrative expenses instead of directed into their accounts or to their credit. And from a fiduciary standpoint, we didn't think that this alternative was justified if other methods that can more equitably align the burden of overpayment with those who receive the overpayments could be pursued. We did a similar analysis on using the contingency reserve or the benefits and force reserve to fund this, and similar conclusions, as I laid out more extensively in my memo, were reached. We have the similar concern in shifting of the burden of this overpayment to future generations, current and future members, and future earnings, rather than looking at, if we can, the people that received the benefit sharing the burden of repaying that. So that leads us to the issue of direct recovery. In other words, going to the individuals that received that overpayment and recovering that overpayment from them. It's legally permissible under ORS 238.715. That's the statute in our chapter that deals with collection of overpayments. And it basically says if the board determines someone was overpaid, then here is the process by which you are to collect that overpayment. That pathway of collecting the overpayment is alluded to both in the Strunk case and the Lipscomb case, so they both gave a nod to method as being the way to recover the funds that we're going to need to fulfill our obligations. While it's true that either the Strunk case or Lipscomb directed that recovery come from retired members, that's because neither action really dealt with the remedy. They just have, Lipscomb just held that these were the things the board had to do. It did not get into detail as to how they were done. And similarly in Strunk, there wasn't a decision as to where that money should come from, just a recognition that that reallocation was going to occur. So this direct recovery is not prohibited by the 2003 legislation nor by court decisions. And in this circumstance, I'm alluding to the letter you received from Greg Hartman on the fixed benefit issue. That letter and the response from Joe Malkin is in your packet. According to Mr. Malkin's analysis, we think that we still are can legally pursue this direct recovery method, and that the decision in Strunk doesn't prevent us from doing that. So legal, there being no legal prohibition about this methodology, we look at the fiscal and fiduciary consequences of it. Fiscally, we need to do individual recalculations, which means we have to embark on a significant effort to understand how each individual was impacted by this overcrediting and accurately assess that allocation's impact on each recipient. But as a fiduciary matter, that comes closest to aligning the recovery of the overpayment from those who receive the benefit of that overpayment. So this slide is, again, just a summary of those possible sources for the Tier 1 recovery, showing that the administrative expense and contingency and VIF reserves have problems either legally, but especially fiscally and from a fiduciary standpoint. Leaving this direct recovery is the method that staff recommends that we pursue. Our goal, though, in this direct recovery is to adopt a method that first off, does not require any upfront payment from a recipient. In other words, this method is only going to be applicable to people that are continuing to receive a monthly benefit. We'll talk later about people who took a lump sum retirement or some other form of payment out of their Tier 1 account and no longer have a monthly relationship with us. But for those people still on a monthly payment, the first goal we established was not to make those people write us a check for a lump sum amount, unless, of course, they choose to do that and choose to pay this obligation off all at once. We wanted to minimize the impact that this benefit payment scheme would have on reductions. In other words, we didn't want to reduce the benefits any more than we had to in an absolute term to recover what we had to recover. We wanted to make those adjustments by a consistent method. All of the benefit payments should be adjusted by the same methodology rather than entering into individual negotiations or even select presenting a wide range of options as to repayments, because we wanted this to be a consistent application of this methodology. And lastly, we're charged with considering the administrative impact on the workforce. That is the last thing that we do look at. So to describe the actuarial reduction method, this is the method that we identified that gets us closest to solving or achieving those goals. Other than saying that it's provided for in OS 238.715.1b, that's a statute that provides the board the authority to actuarially reduce those benefits. I'm going to turn this presentation now over to Mr. Stroud to explain that methodology, how the calculation works, and to work you through the examples that we have.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Craig Stroud, Director or Administrator of the Benefit Payments Division. On the slide before you, you have the actual reduction method. Some bullets describe the precepts to it. As Mr. Rodman declared, it's provided for in statute. What it does is it adjusts the monthly benefit payment to an amount deemed by the actuary to recover the overpayment. In and of itself, it extends repayment over the actuarially determined retiree's lifetime. It's a system-wide solution that treats everyone consistently. From an administrative standpoint, it's a one-time adjustment. It does not require future monitoring or recalculation. And it's based on actuarial balancing of mortality assumptions. It's not a one-time collection, but instead it's an actuarially determined benefit adjustment. So how would you do that? Well, there's really two pieces of history that we need to reconstruct in order to establish how much to actuarially reduce the benefit. there's been a lot of events that have occurred in the last 4 years in the window period, and so we need to take all those into account at a retiree-by-retiree basis in order to determine the overpayment amount. The first thing we would do is we would reconstruct a retiree's account balance for 1999 using 11.33 as the distribution amount for 1999 earnings. We would then bring that payment amount forward to date, assuming COLAs and any other benefit adjustment to which that payment would be normally due, including any impacts of COLA freeze or non-crediting for the reform legislation. So we would establish that amount. Then we would recalculate the benefit based on those 1999 earnings and adjust that benefit for any net that they owe us. And Mr. Rodman's memo is a little bit differently laid out than I wanted to describe it, so I apologize for any confusion. I think the example will readily show how it works. So the first step would be the offset the COLA freeze retroactive payment against any overpayment amount. If there's a surplus in that, if the net of that comes out positive, we would cut the member a check, or the retiree a check, excuse me. If there's an invoice amount still owed, we would reduce their monthly benefit by the actual reduction amount. We begin paying the recalculated payment as of the calculation date. In some cases, that recalculated payment will be higher than their current payment amount. That would be the exception, though. Most people would have some form of a small reduction in a monthly benefit. If the amount is owed to PERS, we reduce the recalculated benefit to reflect recovery of overpayment by the actuarial reduction amount. So let's talk a little bit about the classes of affected members, because there's been so many intervening events between in the window period between 2000 and today. There are several different classes of members you can break the membership into. The combined application of the Strunk-Eugene decisions will generally affect the following groups in the following manner. Effective retirement dates from April of 2000 to March 1st of 2004, that group has all received payable earnings, but many were subject to the COLA freeze that began on 7/1 of 2003. The second class is effective retirement dates from April of 2004 until March 1st of 2005. That group needs to be credited with 2003 earnings, but they did receive COLA in the intervening year. For effective retirement dates after April 1st of 2005, we did calculate all of those benefits, or the majority of those benefits, including both the Strunk and Eugene provisions. So they would need no further benefit adjustment. We also have variable account participants. The 1999 reallocation will have less impact upon those accounts, depending on the relative size of their regular and variable accounts. And then we have a whole host of folks that we would consider miscellaneous. Everyone with an account that received 99 earnings allocation would have some form of adjustment that we would need to look at. Whether we owe them or they owe us would be a matter of individual calculation. So for example, let's take an April 1st, 2001 retirement. 2000 retirement, assuming that we did this calculation on April 1st of 2006. Their current benefit payment is $2,335. The recalculated benefit payment would be $2,299, or a drop of $36 per month, approximately 1.5%. As of April 1st of 2006, they would owe us $9,184 that we would need to recoup. If we took the $9,184 and adjusted that actuarially over the member's remaining life, the impact to the monthly benefit would be $2,271, or a $28 reduction, approximately 1.2%. The total reduction from their current benefit would be $64, approximately 2.7%. And obviously that's an example. People are going to go all around these numbers based upon their account balance, the monthly benefit amount, where in the window they retired. The following slide, slide 18, shows an April 1st, 2004 retirement. Again, assuming an April 1st, 2006 recalculation date. The current benefit amount that they're receiving is $2,275. The recalculated benefit payment is $2,337, or an increase of $63, approximately 2.8%. The amount that we would owe them would equate to $1,483. So you can see that as you move through time, generally, the scenario, the relationship between whether they owe us or we owe them changes. Then you need to factor in whether they have variable money, any other types of specifics to their account. So these are generalities, but that's how this method works. If we look at the actual reduction method and we try to align the goals stated previously by Mr. Rodman to it, it does meet them in the sense that, number one, it requires no check from the recipient at this time, unless, of course, they choose to pay it off. It does minimize the benefit payment reductions on their current monthly annuity by spreading the repayment over an actuarial period, i.e. their lifetime. Number three, it does make consistent adjustments that are spread across the entire PERS system. And number four, it minimizes the administrative impact by using a system-wide approach, and thus limits the number of adjustments and required tracking by PERS staff.
Just to wrap up then briefly on the other issues that we need to also address in this, we will need to develop an implementation plan, a collection policy to recover overpayments for people that are not receiving a monthly benefit. Those individuals will have to calculate and find a way to collect those overpayments on an individual basis. We'll also include a charge-off policy for uncollectible amounts if we're unable to collect those amounts. At what threshold will we decide those just need to be charged off? Part of our recommendation is to waive the recovery of overpayments of $50 and under, and those are on an aggregate basis. That statutory authority is provided to you under, again, 238.715, and we're recommending that you exercise it. And lastly, our recommendation concludes that there is no basis for us to go forward and recover interest or costs on these overpaid amounts, as they don't meet the standard that is stated in 715 for us to recover that interest. So we would collect these on an interest-free basis.
Okay. Excuse me, Steve. What do you think the average cost of doing the administrative cost of doing the recalculation of the benefit would be on a member-by-member basis?
The average cost of doing the recalculation?
More than $50 a head?
Yeah. Yes.
Well over. Okay. Second question, no basis to recover interest. The numbers you've shown under the actuarial method would not only be no interest going backwards to, say, 1999, it would be no interest going forward over the expected mortality of the member. So no interest, say, even 30 years old?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I just might note that those numbers by the actuary were not based on that assumption. So there's about a $35 million hit to those numbers by adopting this recommendation.
So number three would be a couple million dollars, and number four would be $35 million. Number three would be the waiver of $50.
No, number four, just the waiver of interest.
What would number three be?
Yeah. We don't know.
Doesn't matter, it costs you more to do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the conclusion of our presentation.
Thank you. Let me ask the other board members what questions they've got for Mr. Rodman and Mr. Stroud at this stage. James, anything else you want to add at this point? Tom?
This is probably the meeting that I dreaded coming to. I've read a lot of emails, and I think staff was in that. Wonderful job of coming up with the least painful way to do something under statute. And I was glad to see this added, that the no interest for something that they had no control over to begin with. So I thank you for that.
Brenda?
Very nice presentation. I don't have any questions at this time.
Eva?
I agree about the nice presentation part. I did have a question. How many recipients do we have that aren't currently receiving monthly payments?
That goes back to the slide about the withdrawals and the, there's like 6,000 withdrawals, probably about 1,500 alternate payees. So we're guessing probably they have about 7,500 to 8,000 people.
Okay, and I don't have any additional comments at this point either, Steve. You guys want to finish off with anything else, or should we start with general comments? Okay, Paul, do you have anything you want to say at this stage?
No,
okay, clearly there are many different perspectives on this topic, and it's important for us to hear all of those, and I'd like to start with various legal opinions on both the issue we face and if people so desire discussion of the approach. And we have several people that are willing to speak for various constituencies today. Mr. Hartman representing the coalition, Mr. Bill Gary representing certain employers, and Mr. Joe Malik, who represents the board. And let me just pause here. Bill or Greg, either of you want to go first for the matter? Mr. Hartman? I think you got the chair.
Excuse me, for the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm here representing the First Coalition. And I want the record to note that Mr. Gary just wants rebuttal, which is why he was so polite in allowing me to hear first. Two things I'd like to comment on today. I sent the board a letter a number of weeks ago in which I stated some concerns about where you go from here. I think it's fair to say that all of us were somewhat disappointed in the City of Eugene case that the Supreme Court chose to declare the case moot rather than answering a lot of questions for us. So it leaves us in a position where we don't have definitive answers to many questions we hoped we had, and obviously all of us will have to go forward and perhaps seek those answers in another forum. But the reason I wrote to the board, and first of all, I was not trying to express any comprehensive analysis of the rights of participants, beneficiaries, or retirees within the system. Nor was I trying to lay out all the issues that I think may ultimately be of significance in determining those. My letter was really very, very limited to the issues raised in the Strunk case, which I felt had an immediate impact on what we refer to as the window retirees.
Pause here for a second. Yes. I would appreciate it if somebody's not using a flash camera during the meeting. Thank you very much.
And in essence, and I'm not going to go through the whole letter because you've had the opportunity to read it and I will be happy to answer questions, but our position is really relatively simple. To set the background, the 2003 legislature said for the window retirees, we're going to cure the 99 overdistribution by taking away your COLA for some period of time. We challenged that, and we said that's unconstitutional or a breach of contract. And I'm going to water our positions down very simply and say that we took the position on behalf of the participants that they were retired, you couldn't take away their benefits, and that the COLA itself was a contractual benefit. And the court agreed with us. The defendants took the position that's all fine and good, but if the benefit was based on an improper distribution of income in 1999, you can't have a contract right in something which was improperly done. The court agreed with them too. And so we had a circumstance where the court decided to resolve these issues in a way really none of us argued on either side of the issue. And what the court said, and I'm going to read two sentences from the court's opinion, is that despite the fact that you've made, on the other side, they made the argument about 238.715 and improperly distributed funds, and despite the arguments we made, the court said you have overlooked something very important, and that is the legislation established what the legislation itself referred to as the fixed service retirement. And the legislature defined that, as I recall, as the amount somebody was receiving on July 1, 2003, or if they retired after that date, the amount they received when they retired. And here's what the court, two sentences on page 48, for those of you who carry around a copy of Strunk because you find it such interesting reading. I'm going to read two sentences. And the court said, however, the fixed retirement allowance itself represents a determined allowance. And they highlighted those words, determined allowance. That is an allowance expressly determined by the legislature. In light of that legislative determination, the fixed service retirement allowance cannot be said to transfer to the affected member any funds to which the member, and now in parentheses, again in the legislature's determination, close parentheses, was not entitled. Now we read that language to simply and straightforwardly say that the legislature, when they determine the fixed service allowance, once they have made that determination, you can no longer describe that amount as something to which someone is not entitled. And in the remainder of the opinion, the court goes on to point out that you cannot apply 238.7.115 to it because the language of 715 talks about the recovery of something to which you are not entitled. What the Strunk court said is you were entitled to this. And on top of that, because we all know they set aside that portion of the statute which said no COLA, they said not only are you entitled to this, but you are entitled to your COLA. So we believe, setting aside any other legal arguments, and there may be lots of other legal arguments we could get into, we believe that the Strunk determination makes it clear that the legislature took action, which, if you will, cuts across all these issues, and that this fixed service requirement is now mandatory. And it doesn't make any difference what Judge Lipscomb thought, and it doesn't make any difference what the Supreme Court may have thought about in reviewing Judge Lipscomb's opinion, because remember, it is ultimately the legislature who speaks and determines benefits in this system. We think that resolves the question, and we believe, based on that language, that there is no basis for the PERS Board to recover any of those payments. As a matter of fact, we think what the PERS Board is compelled to do is to basically honor that fixed determination and to pay the COLA to those folks who have not received it. Now, I will be the first to admit that this opinion is not the model of clarity. They rarely are. And there are footnotes in here, and there are comments about, you know, we're establishing the status quo at least for now, whatever that means. I'm sure Mr. Gary will elucidate those and tell us what he thinks those mean. But you have to look at the central core of the determination in the Strunk case, and I think it's contained in those two sentences. We think that that's basically what determines what the board should do in this case. The only other thing, and I'm happy to answer questions if any of you have questions, but the only other thing I'd like to say, and that is I appreciate that legal opinions vary, there are disagreements. Your counsel has already indicated his disagreement with our position. Obviously, you must respect his opinion. And my assumption is, at least today, you're probably going to go forward and take the next steps towards this recovery. And I'd simply like to say on behalf of the PERS Coalition that though we think that's not the right step, we very much appreciate the staff recommendation, and we very much appreciate that it appears that you're heading in the direction to do this with it with as little pain to the retirees out there as possible. So I didn't want to get away from here without saying that though we disagree with you on the underlying principle of how you go, of whether you should go forward, we do very much appreciate the hard work of the staff and the staff recommendation and the fact that they have sought out what appears to us to be the least painful way to go forward if you ultimately decide that's what you want to do. So that's our position. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if not, then I'll let your other invited speakers come up here. And
thank you. That was very helpful, as usual. And appreciate the comments at the end as well. Mr. Hartman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gary.
Mr. Chair, while Mr. Gary's coming up, I just want to make sure the audience realizes that we did include a copy of Mr. Hartman's letter in the agenda item, as well as a copy of Mr. Malkin's response. We got Mr. Gary's letter a little late to include in there, and that's why you got it as part of the walk-in today. But if you're interested in seeing the entire letters, they are attached to the agenda items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Bill Gary. I'm a member of the law firm of Farang Long Gary Rudnick. We represent the petitioning employers in the City of Eugene litigation. We also represent the defendant local government employers in the Strunk litigation, as well as the Oregon Health Sciences University in that litigation. On behalf of all of those employers, let me say first that we support the staff recommendation that is before you. And as the previous speaker indicated, appreciate the effort of the staff to address this very prickly problem in a manner calculated to be as painless as possible under the circumstances. And I would like to also commend your staff and council for the careful attention that they have given to what is at best a very, very complex and difficult problem. Before I take a minute to respond to Mr. Hartman's comments concerning the Strunk case, let me just take a second to review the bidding in terms of how we got here, because I think it helps to put the decision that you have to make today in context. When the petitioning employers in the City of Eugene case were successful in the circuit court and got a decision that, among other things, held that the 1999 earnings allocation was an abuse of discretion, that in effect the PERS board, the prior PERS board, had erred in failing to fund the contingency reserve and failing to follow its own policy with respect to funding what was then called the gain loss reserve. We became immediately involved in the legislative effort to attempt to address the problems that were created by errors in the past in a way that was going to be as fair as possible. Governor Kulongoski at that time gave us a roadmap of conditions that he would need to see satisfied in order for him to support reform legislation, and we drafted legislation in an effort to comply with the governor's conditions. Two of those conditions were that no PERS retiree would see a reduction in their benefit, and that no PERS member would see a reduction in their account balance. Given the fact that a circuit court at that point had concluded that the account balances were overstated because of excessive crediting of investment income for 1999, that presented a fairly daunting challenge. The solution that the legislature and the governor ultimately crafted was what I will refer to as the interest crediting provisions of House Bill 2003. In essence, what they attempted to do was to fix the problem on a going forward basis, preserving account balances and preserving retirement benefits, but providing for freezes on future crediting to current members, and also providing for the cost of living adjustment freeze. Those who were unhappy with the reform legislation, several of them filed the Strunk litigation, and as you know, the Supreme Court concluded that those interest crediting provisions were unconstitutional. Now, after the legislation was passed, my clients were in an interesting position because we had a court order directing the PERS board to reallocate the 1999 earnings. And we have legislation that attempted to address the same problem on a going forward basis. We could have simply insisted that the PERS board follow the mandate of the circuit court, which was not stayed and you were obligated to follow, and let the legislation play out. But rather than do that, we agreed to enter into the compromise that became the settlement agreement. And in that settlement agreement, my clients and the PERS board agreed that the 1999 earnings would not have to be reallocated, notwithstanding the circuit court's ruling, so long as the interest crediting provisions of the reform legislation were allowed to take effect. When the interest crediting provisions were invalidated, as your staff said, under the settlement agreement, that triggered the reallocation of the 1999 earnings. As it happens, and is always the case when you're dealing with the law of large numbers, there are winners and losers when you pick your solution. And undoubtedly, there are many people who retired, the so-called window retirees, who, looking at it now, would say, you know, a COLA freeze looks pretty good to me. But the Supreme Court made it clear that the COLA freeze was not a workable solution. And I think the principle, unlike Mr. Hartman, I'm not going to focus on two sentences in the Strunk's opinion, which weighs about a pound. I'm going to focus on the rationale that underlay the entire analysis of the Supreme Court. What the court said was that certain statutory provisions in the PERS statutes constitute contractual promises, and that forms the terms upon which the contract operates. Prior to the 2003 legislation, there was no provision to correct overpayments by means of a cost of living adjustment freeze. And so even though that may be a more a rational, good idea, it was not something that the legislature or this board could force upon retirees, even though those retirees, according to the circuit court's decision, were receiving benefits in excess of those benefits to which they were legally entitled, because their benefits were calculated on the basis of inflated account values. The reason that the proposal that you have before you today does not run afoul of those contractual promises is because the statutes that formed the contract include the statute that authorizes the PERS board to collect overpayments in the manner that is being proposed today. It may not be the best way to do it, but it is the way that the contract specifies overpayments are to be dealt with. And therefore, it is the best tool that this board has to fulfill its responsibility to make sure that all PERS members are receiving benefits to which they are entitled, and that you are not spending money from the trust fund to pay benefits in excess of what members are entitled to receive. Now, Mr. Hartman seizes upon the method that the legislature used to adopt the COLA freeze. What the legislature did was take a pretty simple concept and wrote it up in a way that takes some time studying it to try to figure out what it does. But basically, what they said was calculate two different benefits. Calculate the benefit that the member would have received had they been credited with 11.3% in 1999, as they should have been. And that will be the, I think they call it, revised benefit. And then calculate the benefit that they were entitled to in 2003 or at the time that they retire. Mr. Hartman stated it as calculate the benefit that they are receiving, but if you look at the legislation, what it actually says is calculate the benefit that they were entitled to receive. When this board actually reallocated the 1999 earnings to 11.3%, the two calculations yield the exact same number, because when you calculate the benefit that the members were entitled to receive, it is based upon an allocation in 1999 of 11.3%. and the legislature told you to calculate the revised benefit at 11.3%. So that's the first problem with Mr. Hartman's suggestion that somehow the legislature, in attempting to provide a mechanism to recoup the overpayments, froze those overpayments and created some sort of statutory right for people to receive more money than they were otherwise entitled to receive. The second problem with his formulation is the section that of the legislation that he is relying on has nothing whatsoever to do with benefit levels other than the cost of living adjustment. If you go to the section, which is section 10.1 of the reform legislation, what it says at the beginning is, notwithstanding the cost of living statute, cost of living increases for a service retirement allowance that is payable to or on account of the window retirees may be made only as provided in this section. Everything that Mr. Hartman read to you is contained in a section that deals only with cost of living adjustments. And what he's telling you is that in a section that deals only with cost of living adjustments, the legislature somehow created an entitlement to receive a fixed benefit. That's not what the statute says. And in invalidating that portion of the statute, the Supreme Court, as your counsel pointed out in his letter, made it crystal clear that that's all they were doing, was saying whatever right you may have or duty you may have to recoup overpayments, you cannot do it by means of a COLA freeze. And they have, in the words that Mr. Hartman alluded to, as well as a footnote, made it clear that they were not saying that you did not have the authority to recoup the overpayments. So while I'm accustomed to frequently disagreeing with Mr. Hartman, every lawyer has an opinion, I don't think that the argument that he's put before you really is an impediment to the staff recommendation. And let me finally say that I also differ with Mr. Hartman in regard to the statement that he made that there are so many open questions that need to be resolved after the Strunk decision and the City of Eugene decision. It is true that in the City of Eugene case, the court granted my client's motion to dismiss the case as moot. But what's interesting about the way that they did it was that they did not base that exclusively upon the fact that the case had been settled. They based it also upon the decisions, the law that they gave to all of us in the Strunk decision. And I think if you take the Strunk decision and the City of Eugene decision in combination, it had those cases, the Supreme Court has answered many of the questions that were at the core of the dispute between Mr. Hartman's clients and my clients over the last several years. Now, I realize it's going to take some time for all of that to sort out, but I'm more optimistic that we are closer to the end than I think Mr. Hartman's comments may have suggested. And I think this board can take an important step today to bringing needed certainty and closure for the benefit not only of my clients, the employers, but for the benefits of our employees who need and deserve to know where they stand with regard to their retirement benefits. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Gary? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Malkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Joseph Malkin, Laura Currington and Sutcliffe, counsel to the board in the Strunk litigation, the City of Eugene litigation, the White litigation, and all of the related litigation. I'd like to address the board in a broader context rather than the focus that you just heard from Mr. Hartman and Mr. Gary. And that's to step back and look at the very difficult situation that you as a board are confronted. And it's one that is made difficult because of the human element. From a legal standpoint, it is not as difficult an issue. The board has a fiduciary duty to the members of the PERS system as a whole. And that fiduciary duty includes maintaining the fiscal soundness of the system and of the PERS fund. It does not include maximizing the benefits for any given individual or any given group of individuals, but rather acting fairly and prudently to the system and the members as a whole. The situation with which you find yourselves confronted today is that the 1999 earnings crediting decision was declared illegal. Judge Lipscomb ruled that the prior board had abused its discretion, and in so doing, by failing to fund the reserves, had overcredited Tier 1 member accounts, and he voided that decision. Now, rather than continue to spend money to defend a decision that the current board agreed was indefensible, and in light of the reform legislation that was passed, the board entered into a settlement agreement that Mr. Berry has described both historically and what it accomplished. Interestingly, the Legislative Assembly agreed with Judge Lipscomb with the conclusion reached in the settlement agreement that the appropriate earnings crediting to Tier 1 member accounts for 1999 was 11.33%, not the 20% that the prior board had actually credited. Now, the fact that certain individuals received payments based on the erroneous 20% calculation created what the Supreme Court in Strunk said is a funding gap. And you've heard from Mr. Hartman his preferred approach. And what he says is Strunk settled the issue. The Legislative Assembly actually determined that the erroneous benefit payments that were at the heart of the City of Eugene litigation, that were what the Legislative Assembly was trying to fix through the PERS reform legislation, is in fact what the retirees are entitled to. I submit to you that the Legislative Assembly would be stunned to hear that they had put into law a provision that requires that, notwithstanding all of the subsequent events, and so with the Strunk Court. The Strunk Court, Mr. Hartman cites his two sentences, and we cite two other sentences. There is no question in my mind that what the Strunk Court was dealing with was the legality of the COLA freeze in the context of the COLA provisions of the PERS legislation. And what the court concluded is you cannot take away COLA on any benefit that is being paid. And thus what the legislature did in trying to recoup the overpayments of the past was illegal as a method. But the court very clearly said, and I'm going to quote it again because it is important, they said, our conclusion that that particular legislative action amounted to a breach of the PERS contract, however, implies nothing about PERS or, for that matter, the legislature's authority to recover amounts determined to have been paid from the fund in error. So my analysis fundamentally disagrees with Mr. Hartman in his basic argument that the board is powerless, that the Strunk Court has ruled that the Legislative Assembly has established a benefit level, although based on an admittedly erroneous calculation that cannot be changed. And that brings us back to the tough human decision. But again, what I think is a fairly clear legal decision, and that is the question, how do you close this gap? Well, I know Mr. Hartman's preferred solution is leave the benefits in place and have the employers pick up the extra cost. Well, one thing that the Legislative Assembly did rather unambiguously make clear is that is not an option that the board has. In Section 14B of HB 2003, subsection 2, the Legislative Assembly said, in no event may the cost of erroneous benefit calculation methods identified in City of Eugene et al., the State of Oregon, be considered an employer liability or charged to employers through employer contributions. Now that is an unambiguous direction to this board, that the one thing you can't do is the one thing that Mr. Hartman wants you to do. So then you're left with looking at the various other alternatives that your staff, I think, analyzed extremely well. You could try to charge the extra benefits to administrative expenses. That, as the staff memorandum points out, results in current members subsidizing higher than appropriate benefits to a subclass of members who have now retired. That, in our view, would not be consistent with the best fiduciary practices. That would not be viewing your fiduciary duty as being to the members as a whole. Rather, a much larger group of current members would be paying, in effect, a subsidy in order to provide higher benefits to past members. Similarly, using the contingency reserve, again, because of the legislative mandate that in no event is any portion of this cost to be charged to employers, using the contingency reserve, again, has the ultimate effect of having current members of the system pick up the cost of the additional benefits that have been paid and will be paid out in the future to this subgroup of retirees. And again, in our view, that would not be consistent with the best fiduciary practices. That would not be necessarily consistent with maintaining the fiscal soundness of the system, nor in achieving fairness to the members as a whole, as opposed to a subgroup that, as I said before, on a human level, has a case that appeals to every one of us. And that leaves the direct recovery method. And the staff, I think Mr. Hartman really summed that up well. The staff has done just an outstanding job of wrestling with this very difficult issue and coming up with a method that is certainly not going to make everybody happy. It may not make any of the people that fall in that class happy, and I don't expect to get the applause that Mr. Hartman got when I'm done. But as even Mr. Hartman acknowledged, they came up with a method that takes a bad situation and creates the least pain out of it. So stepping back, we, from a fiduciary standpoint and based on the analysis of Strunk and the legislation, our recommendation to the board is the direct recovery method. No matter how you characterize any other method, given the legislative mandate that employers not pay any part of this cost, the result is that current members subsidize past members, and that is simply not the best fiduciary practice. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think the perspectives all three of you have been extremely helpful. And let me just ask if anybody, like I've asked of the others, if anybody's got any questions for Mr. Malkin.
Just a comment. I rarely say this to a lawyer, but thank you for the clarity.
You're welcome.
We say it to Brenda. Thank you. Okay, we're now going to embark on a little process to get audience participation to allow people to express their views. I'm trying to do this in an orderly manner, so bear with me as I try to go through a little bit of a methodology to make this work. We have in the audience some representatives, as I understand it, of OEA, and I'm going to start with what I consider maybe a little panel. Ask people to be extremely brief, but I understand these three individuals at least can speak for themselves and possibly represent some others. Then I'm going to have several people speak from the employer side, and then I'm going to open it up, and I've got a number of cards here from people that are desirous to speak, and I will accommodate as many as I can within some kind of reasonable time frame until we feel like we're repeating ourselves. So let me start with by asking Janet Jackson, Joe Cheever, and Mike Arkin to come forward if they would. And I think we need one more chair if there's a possibility of grabbing that somewhere. Thanks, Steve.
Oh, no, yes, sir.
Here's my request. First of all the speakers, you need to state your name clearly for the record, and then I would ask that people be fairly brief in their comments to allow as many comments from everybody in the room as possible. Thank you for coming forward. Please feel free.
My name is Janet Jackson. I taught kindergarten and first grade for 20 years in the Hillsborough School District after 12 years of teaching in the states of Georgia and Washington. I retired November 1st, 2003, and finished off that school year at a greatly reduced salary and paying my own insurance benefits because I didn't want to leave my class in the lurch in the middle of the year. I've asked to tell you how the proposed changes will affect me personally. Looking at the information given to me by OEA, it looks like my benefit would be decreased about $70 a month, and I would have to pay back about $3,200. I'm not sorry I retired at the age of 55 after 32 years in a profession that I love still. But changes in education and the PERS reform spurred me to make that decision to protect my own health and sanity. The benefit statements I received from PERS in the several years prior to my retirement were, of course, extremely influential in my decision, as well as my husband's willingness to work for at least another 5 years. Because I was only teaching in Oregon for 20 years, my benefit covers my modest house payment and medical insurance for my husband and myself. My insurance will go up $61 a month on October 1st to $844 for the two of us. That's through my school district. PERS proposes to decrease my benefit, as I said, by about $70. And of course, the insurance is going to keep going up year after year. I don't know how I'm going to afford that at this point. I'm just getting used to living on a more fixed income, and now it's kind of going to get unfixed, and it concerns me a lot.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Michael Arkin. I'm an AFSCME retiree, worked for the City of Portland for 23 years. I retired February 1st, 2002. I'd like to make a comment about the green and yellow cards. Those cards, those people did not want to speak. They just wanted to submit their comments.
Thank you. Some have a check mark saying they wish to speak to the board, so we'll get through it.
I'm confused too. The Strunk decision and all these legal decisions have done what a friend of mine has called unrung a bell. And that's a bell that, as retirees, most of us can't unring. We made irrevocable, life-changing decisions to retire based on information we received from the board. My notice of entitlement never said subject to change without notice.
Right.
As to unringing the bell, the board erred. We've heard that from all the attorneys. Would it be fair to say then, looking back, the board was are responsible. Because if we say that, if we use that as a legal precedent, then looking back, I was irresponsible to retire. And since I'm going to give this back, because you're saying so, I would like to stop it right there, and I would like my job back, and my age back, and my benefits back. Thank you.
Thank you both. This is the last of the orchestrated comments, orchestrated only meaning that I have names in front of me. So may I hear from the lawyer representing me, Mr. Steve Manton, and Karen Artico and Deborah Guzman. I think I've got the pronunciation correct.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Steve Manton for the City of Portland. I just wanted to comment that I've had the opportunity to read through the staff recommendations, and I believe that the staff did a very good job of trying to bring together a very difficult subject and find some way to make it possible for the least amount of pain for all of the current recipients of their benefits. We do support the staff recommendation. Thank you.
Karen Argiaco, the Risk and Benefits Manager for Lane County. I noted with interest Director Cleary's comments about receiving 300 plus or minus emails. I too have received probably over the last few years probably twice that many. And the answer was usually we need to play this out through the courts and see what happens, and then the PERS board needs to make its decisions. And here we are at the end of that long trail. I know you will take into account all of the comments that will be made in this room today, but I ask you that however difficult it may be, and I'm sure it will be, that in your decision making, you ultimately look to the ORS rules for PERS, the letter and spirit of the court decisions, as well as the advice from your own legal counsel and staff. The rules and court decisions support the continued financial health and stability of PERS, as well as the board's fiduciary responsibility to all PERS members, active and inactive. Whatever your decision, I urge you to adopt a plan of action that relies upon your staff and council's research and recommendations. Thank you.
I'm Deborah Guzman, speaking on behalf of Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'd like to commend you for your service as a board member and fiduciaries for the trust and serving now through this very difficult and challenging time. Thank you also for not calling in sick today. This is going to be difficult to show up. I'd encourage you to stand firm in making this series of decisions that are legally defensible and recognize your fiduciary responsibilities and that fairly and equitably allocate the fiscal recovery among those directly and erroneously receiving excessive distributions from this trust. While I am sure the sheer magnitude of affecting 36,000 people's benefits is gut-wrenching, the sheer volume of not recovering $1.6 billion of trust assets must outweigh. Thank you for the board and staff and actuaries and collaborative effort to work out a method that I believe is both compassionate in its nature through its extended lifetime and fair, and finally provides the stability I think retirees and employers and our taxpayers need throughout Oregon.
Thank you all. Okay, we're now at 2:20, and I think we have time for a number of comments, and I would like to hear them. And I don't know the best way to go about this, except, Paul, I have a stack of cards here of the people who said that they're interested in speaking, most of whom have been kind enough to say 1 to 2 minutes. And if people would stick to that, I think we can get through a lot of comments. So I, without in any particular order, I'm just going to ask if people are in the room and if they still would like to speak, and if they would, great, and if not, I'm going to move on. So with that, Linda Crane.
I'm a little minnow in a big fish, a big sea of fish of 27,000. I say little minnow because...
Linda, let me just pause you there for a moment. For the record, I'm going to ask everybody that comes forward to state their name for the record before they begin.
Linda Crane.
Thank you.
The little minnow. I retired at the age of 59, and What has been said today by various people, Mr. Malcolm spoke of fiduciary duty. Mr. Gary said the present employees should know where they stand. And when I retired, I received a piece of paper that was the result of an individual consultation that told me where I stood. And I believed it. And I quit my job. And I was 59. And I'm sure that there are many people who are in that same capacity. We understand the difficulty of the money being repaid. We understand the difficulty that erroneous information was given to us. But nevertheless, we are the ones who are going to bleed. And when we speak about the whole PERS membership, we are the group that really are at a disadvantage because we're older, we don't have our jobs, and here we are. Thank you.
Barney Gorder.
Right here. Can somebody move the chair? Thank you.